This is the Anderson Files on PodClip. The Anderson Files is a look at commerce, investment, economics, and retirement issues that affect each and every one of you. Your host is Mike Anderson, Executive Vice President, Retirement Services, and partner of Finestone Partners. Finestone Partners is an independent firm with securities offered through Four Point Capital. And now your host, Mike Anderson.
The COVID-19 pandemic and real estate. How is buying, selling, prices, lending being affected? My guest today, Jeff Barton, broker with Malibu Funding. He has been in real estate since 1995 and mortgage lending since 2002. He covers California, Arizona, Texas, Nevada, Washington. Jeff also hosts a weekly radio show discussing topics related to mortgages, real estate, and trends in the industry. Jeff, good morning.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great. We're 3 months into, 3 months plus into the pandemic. Real estate prices, how are they being affected in Southern California?
Okay, so in Southern California, the problem here has always been a lack of product. So because of the COVID-19, they stopped building. So the prices really have remained very steady. We haven't seen a dip, maybe in certain areas, maybe in certain demographic locations, but overall the prices have remained very, very steady. Now, how does that affect what's happening going forward? We're not sure, because we know that the people who have been into forbearance, and forbearance, as you know, are people that just decided that I don't want to pay my mortgage anymore. Whether you qualify, because there is no qualification standard, what happens then is that they decide they don't want to pay. But if some of those people really have lost their jobs and cannot pay their mortgage, what happens 6, 8, 9, 10 months, a year down the road when those properties begin to go into foreclosure? We're just not sure of the numbers. There's nationally 4.5 million people in forbearance, but that effect on local Southern California stuff is not really going to be felt for a while. So I think prices for now are steady, and they may even see a rise because as the economy opens up, we're going to see a lot more people who want to buy. They want a lot more people who are out there trying to get in on whatever real estate they can.
With those that have chosen forbearance, any feel for those that really needed to do it, or the percentage that did it just as a precaution, just in a what-if scenario?
You know, it's
tough one.
I know. It's just, I wish we had the answer, because I think if you're told in any regard that you don't have to pay your bill and there's no recourse, why would you pay the bill? I mean, I do, because that's just me. But there are a lot of people who just, why should I? Especially now that we have rates in the lending world at 2.5%. So if you're a person who got a mortgage at 4.25% a year and a half ago, and you're saying, look, I don't have to pay my mortgage for a while. Now you've seen the rates go down to 2.5%. Well, why don't you just refi and not have to pay that money? You have to pay it on the back end when you pay off the note, but at the same time, it's a win-win. So there's no real penalty for lying, I guess is what it is, and we have no real idea what the numbers are. When they came out with the program, they had no fix for what was to be, I guess, the criteria to qualify. There is no qualification. You just, if you say you can't pay, you don't pay.
And there's no effect on credit as well by choosing forbearance.
That's interesting. All right. So we've had probably since the program started issues with credit. What happens? Now, we've been told by Fannie and Freddie, the first guidelines that came out, the guidance was, okay, you cannot report, the servicers cannot report these as being delinquent. However, on the credit reports, it was showing that there were payment issues. So the score didn't reflect the non-payment, but the underlying explanations did. Well, last week, what happened is the CFPB came out with further guidance that said, right, no, you can't even go deep into the credit report and find it. So what happens, and this is one of the problems with, if we get into foreclosures a year from now, we will have no preemptive way to understand what happens along the way. If someone's lost their job and they've gone into forbearance, it right, doesn't affect their credit score. So ostensibly, those people can continue to, I guess, not be affected by the fact that they're not paying their mortgage. They can get a credit card, they can buy a car, even though they don't have a job. However, we're not quite sure whether this is the end of, I guess, the guidance from CFPB. They're working it out as they're going along, and it's really by the seat of your pants. That's the way I see it.
At this point.
Yeah.
During this period, has lending changed?
Yes. Yes, it
could
has.
You describe that?
Of course, of course. So there was a sector called non-QM. You know what that is. But for people that don't know what that is, if you are a W-2 employee and somebody wants to go out and get a loan, and you've been working at a job over 2 years, and you've got good credit, and good credit before the pandemic was anything over 700, 680, 700. You could even get a loan if you had a 580 credit score. But let's say that you had a 680 and above credit score, you had a W-2 job, you could get a standard loan bought in the secondary market by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. However, if you didn't fit in that world, in that box, you were a self-employed person, you owned your own business, you had a lot of equity in your home, but you didn't necessarily have a lot of income, there were loan products for you, and they were called non-QM. QM stands for qualified mortgages. So in that world of non-qualified mortgages, 30% of the mortgages done prior to COVID were non-QM. But when COVID hit, non-QM got knocked out of the box because nobody was buying those loans once they were made.
Right.
And that was a problem. So what happened to those 30% of the mortgages? And we're talking $1.5 trillion mortgage business every year. So $500 billion got, you know, there were no market for those people. So yes, it did get affected. We have seen since that time some of the non-QM business come back. Some of the business bank statement loans, some of the equity-based loans, but they've all been adjusted, i.e. higher credit score, higher costs, of course. Anything that causes risk is going to cost you more money. But that's pretty much what I see. Your standard W-2 employed person, they're not affected at all.
For refis, are you seeing an uptick in refis from a standpoint of lower rates, even though the economy has slowed down?
So,
what type of activity do you see there?
Yeah, well, it's the since the last downturn in 2008,
right?
The mortgage crisis at that time. We have not seen business this robust since that time. Now, we've had a 12-year run of mortgage business that has been spectacular. And for anybody out there who is not sure what that means, because of the rates, because the way the rates have trended, and that's downward on a trajectory from 2008 to today, where, as I said, you can go out and get a FHA mortgage today at 2.5%. You can get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for 3% or just under 3%. You can get a jumbo product under 4%. Now, jumbo, of course, is depending on the county you live in. These are amazing times we're living in. And so as a result, we are seeing last month, for instance, we had more mortgage applications for purchases, not just refis, but purchases than we've had in 11 years. Now, that says something because people are out of work. We were thinking, we're not going to have a purchase market. Well, just the opposite. Because of lack of housing, as we talked about, because demand is still strong, and of the 40 million people, let's say 40 million people are out of work, how many of those people were actually qualified to purchase? How
right.
many of those were low-end economic jobs, meaning that they were making less than $30,000 a year? And in our market, unless you're living in rural Indiana or someplace down in, Florida, you can't afford a house at $30,000 a year. You know, not in Southern California anyway. No way. Yep. You have to have 19 people with 30 grand a year in order to afford a house.
To team up and pool those dollars. Right. Exactly.
Right.
In this period, would you say it's better to be a buyer or a seller?
Well, it's good point, right? I mean, we always say, because if you find something you like, you buy it, but it is still a seller's market. I live in Malibu, California, and I have a client that I'm pricing a medium-priced condominium out here. And that medium price in Malibu is $950,000, okay? And as a result of lack of product out here, the last product that sold was about $930,000. There aren't many units available under $1 million. So, you know, that's a pretty good deal for a condo he bought 4 or 5 years ago for $150,000 less. So I would say it's probably a seller's market.
Overall, how are you seeing areas like Silicon Beach down in the Santa Monica area? How would you characterize that market?
Well, anything on the beach is always going to have demand, right? I mean, obviously, we had beach erosion all along Southern California for the probably the last 20 years. We've seen an erosion in the beaches. But if you are in a building with units, you're probably going to retain your equity, as well as obviously see a rise in equity. We've been seeing rise in equity anyway at 6.5% a year. Even this year, we're going to see a rise in equity on a lot of property. As an average of 3 to 5%. But beachfront, I mean, I love that down there in Santa Monica, all the way down through Venice,
right?
Even past the airport into the South Bay. It's really beachfront property. There's only so much of it, and I think it retains and even grows equity this year.
You're listening to the Anderson Files. I'm Mike Anderson. My guest, Jeff Barton. For the work that you do in different states between California, Arizona, Texas, Nevada, Washington, how would you compare the markets, those other markets, to California? Are they much different? Are they more robust? Are they flat? How would you characterize the metropolitan areas in these other states?
Well, because of what's going on, it depends on the area, right? If you're talking in Miami or you're talking in Chicago, some of the areas we do business around the D.C. area, all of these metropolitan areas are currently involved with either rioting, civil disobedience, unrest, not to mention the COVID issues. So all of this is affecting what's happening in the real estate markets. I mean, if somebody is looking to buy or sell in those areas, they're going to be a little nervous right now. Same with Los Angeles or San Francisco. As you know, we also are up in Seattle. My son lives up in Seattle, went through the area the other day in a pouring rainstorm. And all of these areas are still in demand. It's like COVID itself. Are we looking for down and up really quick, what they call the V-shaped recovery? I think in real estate, prices have remained steady, and people are waiting, holding their breath. But in terms of the, you know, overall, every market's a little bit different, and the prices are certainly different, but the demand is still there because nationally we are short of housing. That's one of the issues that hasn't been addressed, because you can't address housing nationally. You have to address it city by city, location by location. And because there's no will to build low-income housing in places like I live, Malibu, or in some of these other places, what you get is a concentration of an economic group that is unable to sustain or to be able to, I guess, increase the amount of housing in their own area because they're struggling. They're trying to pay their mortgages. But, you know, in terms of prices, overall, nationally, I think they're going to hold. I think they're going to increase. And I do not think there's much of a difference in terms of demand and supply in most areas.
For Southern California to get behind building more, a mandate to build more, is this really out of the city council, the mayor's office? Is that where it starts, or is it more at the state level and focusing on LA?
You know, I think look, Garcetti, right, 2 years ago came up with, okay, we have 50,000 people who don't have a house or a home. We need to set up a fund. So there was a bond measure passed. I think it created $2 billion in order to do that. Well, that money's still sitting there. There are no housing. This is an issue. It is a local issue in smaller cities to be able, and we're not talking about a huge number of units that need to be built, but we need a huge number of municipalities, cities, towns to be able to locally get the will to build one, two. And if you did that across the spectrum of the United States or even locally here in Southern California, you would begin to see an effect on the homeless population. But this is a group that needs so much more than just housing, right? They need mental health care. They need pharmacological help. They need all kinds of support in order to, you know, and there's never been will to do that. People want to throw money at it, but it's not a solution that's going to really help. I don't know the answer. I just know that in the housing area, if we did it, you know, if we don't build the big units and shove everybody in there like a Nickerson Gardens or some other places down in South Central, which turned out to be a disaster. That's my opinion. I don't know. I'm sure there's plenty of opinions out there.
And with building, if it does happen where there's more and a mandate for more, what areas from your perspective would be a conducive area? Is it in LA County? Is it out in San Bernardino, Ventura? If there was some mandate, where do you think it would happen?
You know, I couldn't tell you because, and it's funny you say that, because I had been thinking about looking at maps of places. I still think it's an infill situation. Infill, builder term, meaning that if you go to any city, any town, any place, you will see housing, and then you will see a lot that's open, and then you'll go another 20, 30 houses, and then you'll see another lot that's open. So builders come in and they buy all these open areas, and they're called infill deals. I think that's the way it could happen. I think also if they allowed for smaller units rather than the building codes that are currently in place, there's always the fear that any change in the building code is going to affect prices of the neighborhood, and nobody wants that. Heaven forbid that, you know, you accepted something in your neighborhood that drove the price of your house down. And and I'm only being facetious because in Malibu, where I live, I mean, I bought my house back in, what was it, 95, maybe 95. And it was a foreclosure at that time after the recession of 91. And I think we paid $500,000. We had $100,000. Right. We got a $400,000 mortgage. Well, quintupled. That's how much the prices have risen. And I, you know, we didn't do anything other than own the property. So, you know, when I hear people say about property values and how they're going to be devalued, because I'm like, well, if you're like me, this is unearned incremental rise in the worth of my house, where, you know, maybe if we had some other solution to bring smaller units instead of a 5 or 10 or 20,000 square foot lot that's required in a neighborhood, you bring it down. Because I'm a big fan of the tiny house. I think that could solve a lot of the problems, and they're relatively cheap to build. So I think if cities were to do that on infill lots, they could get, you know, two or three of these smaller units, and not inundated neighborhood, but be able to supply somebody, a couple, a single person, which most of these people who need housing are, into properties that they could not only afford, but they could probably be able to maintain. And I think that is a solution. It's not the solution, but it's part of the solution of what's going on in the housing crisis. In LA County last year, they allowed what they called the granny unit or the she shed or whatever it is,
right,
that allowed you as a property owner to build a guest house. And it had to be within certain guidelines, but because, you know, they needed more housing, they allowed that. And I think some people have taken advantage of it.
Jeff, with the initiative or some future initiative to build more, do you see it more as traditional housing as opposed to possibly prefabbed homes and where They're just easier to put up, build, and get in place, as opposed to traditional apartment units, townhouse units, or individual homes?
Well, I happen to like the prefab model, especially if you're talking about cost for cities, counties, and towns. You can, in looking the other day, I saw that you can get housing for as little between $30,000 and $50,000 a unit built. Now, the question of resale and who owns it and how all that would work, it would have to be worked out, because obviously low-income housing has to remain low-income housing. So however that is papered, or restrictions on deeds, however that's done. But if you look at that number that Gil Garcetti wanted in his bond measure, $2 billion, and I think that's a big number.
Right.
If you broke it down and you were able to provide housing at, say, $30,000 a unit, you could house a lot of people. And I don't know if that stops people from coming to Los Angeles for cheap housing. Probably not. But it does get people into homes. And that's really the key to getting the streets cleaner, being able to solve some of the local petty crime issues. And I think that's part of the solution.
As of now, what would you say are the biggest risks for real estate at this point?
We just don't know what's happening with COVID. And we don't know how many of these people in forbearance are going to be foreclosed on. I mean, if we have 4.66 million is the count 2 days ago, people in forbearance. Let's say you get half of those amount of people who get foreclosed upon. Well, if it's in a given geographical area that there's a good percentage of them, it's going to devastate that economy. So anybody that wants to lend in that area is going to be loath to do so, because, like it was back in 08, in Florida, in Vegas, in Arizona, in a lot of these, Utah, and a lot of these places that really overbuilt, they were at the end plowing units under, because it was destroying people that actually could pay their bills if they had seven or eight houses around them that couldn't. So people are nervous in the lending world. They are very nervous. And if the government, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Ginny Mae, aren't buying those notes, you wouldn't have any lending. And so, right now it's a little bit of a nervous time.
Jeff, as we wrap up, any closing thoughts?
I haven't solved anything. I hope. I get frustrated because I've been at this a long time, and recognizing what happens out there in the marketplace, real world, to people who are just trying to, get a foot in the door, own a home, and try to build upon what the society is offering. And I think a lot of the solutions have to do with the fact that ownership in America has been restricted and continues to be so because of the supply of housing and the price of housing. And if we can help in those areas in whatever way we can, yeah, I think that would be a great, and that's all I have to say about that.
Jeff, thanks for being with us today. And for listeners to learn more and to contact you, what's the best way to reach you?
You can always call me on my cell phone. It's area code 310-849-5309. We are in, as you said, 10 states. And we have an office over in Canoga Park in the San Fernando Valley. And I have about 70 or 80 different agents all over the country. So we can certainly help you. If not with the exact solution, we can point you in the right direction.
Jeff, hope to have you back in the future. And great. I hope you have a great rest of the year.
You too, Mike. And thank you very much for having me on the show. I do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Our guest today, Jeff Barton, broker with Malibu Funding. Hope to have him back. Want to thank Gerald Wayne at the controls for this session, producer Mark Allen. I'm Mike Anderson, and you're listening to The Anderson Files. Keep calm and keep listening.
You've been listening to The Anderson Files with Mike Anderson. Visit us at podclip.io and check on the Financial Box for more information on the Anderson Files.